Morning, church. It is good to see with you all. This morning. Good to be with you all. Happy Mother's Day to all you moms out there. It is a special day in the Forest Mill family. My wife and daughter are not here with us this morning. It's been a big day for yesterday for our family. My daughter graduated. You probably didn't know. I was not like trying to single my daughter out for applause. She deserves it. But it was a big day for our family. So they were in Murfreesboro, and we had a little gathering for family yesterday. And then she went to graduation parties for her friends. And then that today they've gone to Nashville for one of our good friends in Nashville who's graduating. So. It's Mother's Day. The mother of my children's not here. My mother doesn't ever want to hear me preach, and so she's not here. But you guys, your moms love you, so that's good for you. All right. It is good. It's a big day. We obviously couldn't be prouder of our daughters, and I'm sure that for those of you who were blessed with great moms, you know what a powerful influence that is. In your life. I mean, me too. I also had a good mother. If you're watching this, Mom, I definitely appreciate you. Mothers are just one of those inexorable forces in our lives. They're just a power for good. If you were blessed with a good mother, you know what I'm talking about. It's like you knew no matter what, no matter how angry your mother might get with you, and even deservedly so, that she still loved you, and that's just such a blessing, and I am so thankful not only that many of us had mothers like that, but that many of you are mothers like that, and God bless you in those endeavors. But it's one of those things that, like, you know, it's one thing to love your kids, right, because they're yours, and they belong to you, and they're a part of you, and you're a part of them, and it's one thing, but what do you do when the kids are not yours? And sometimes some of you have done this, I know, and I've heard stories about how you've taken in kids who were not yours, and how you just became, you know, second parents, or even foster parents, or even adoptive parents to kids who were not yours, and that's just even another step further. But what do you do when the kids are not only not yours, and they're not even kind of yours, but they're just... they're just other. I mean, how do you love the other? Earlier this week, like Joel, I was listening to a podcast. And mine is not to make me better. Mine is to try to make me smarter. And this one was, they were talking about just a couple of things about World War II that I hadn't really thought about. A story in particular that jumped out to me was about the POW camps that were in the U.S. during World War II. And for those of you who are a bit older, and especially those of you who are from this area, you may remember Camp Forest. Does anybody remember Camp Forest? Some of you? Eric's old enough. The place it was obviously still exists. But it opened up in the 20s, and it was primarily used for the trained the U.S. Armed Forces. And then when World War II rolled around, it expanded just exponentially. In fact, some 250,000 soldiers were trained during that time at Camp Forest. And then, as World War II really kicked up, it became a civilian detention facility. And maybe you remember those. You may have heard about those. And it was used to hold, at least Camp Forest was, about 800 citizens, Italian, Japanese and German citizens, not enemy combatants. These are not soldiers. These are just civilians. Either they were citizens of Italy or Germany or Japan who happened to be living in the U.S. at the time war broke out, or else they were U.S. citizens who had immigrated from those countries. Some even second, third generation Japanese citizens in particular were held at these detention camps. And Camp Forest was one of the first of these detention camps and was known for having really pretty deplorable living conditions. The shacks that they lived in that could house five people, and the wooden slats were sometimes gapped pretty badly, such that when it rained, if you were in there, you got wet, and anything you had in there got wet as well. And they slept on army cots, which those of you in the army are like, yeah, I slept on army cots too. They slept on army cots with no sheets, no real bedding to speak of, certainly no mattresses or anything like that. And these were not enemy combatants, just citizens. And it became, in the years that came since then, we've kind of looked back at that and thought, well, that was really kind of terrible for us to do to U.S. citizens or just people who happened to be living here at the time to have these sorts of internment camps. But on May the 12th of 1942, things radically changed for Camp Forest because all of those citizens were shipped out. They were moved to other internment camps, and officially Camp Forest became a POW camp. It expanded once again to house all of these Italian and German and Japanese prisoners of war. Some 24,000 POWs were housed there at Camp Forest during the war. Now, this was at a time, just to give you some perspective, this was at a time when the population of Tullahoma was 4,500 citizens. You've got, three times the amount of, or four times to five times the amount of prisoners as you do citizens. And the effect was really marked. And these camps were really different than the civilian internment camps. In fact, conditions for the POWs were much better. POWs were given a lot more food. I don't know if you knew that or not. In fact, so much that I was reading an account or listening to an account about one of the POW camps was down in a little bitty town in Alabama called Aliceville. And these German soldiers, they were from Hitler's North African regiment, which were called the super soldiers. I mean, they were really to be feared. And they come into the camp in Aliceville, Alabama, and they're scared to death. They don't know what's going to happen. But the U.S. soldiers started serving them food, and it was so much food that they never had or didn't know what to do with. Some they liked, some they didn't like. But they were given so much of it that they didn't know what to do with it. And they were afraid of giving it back, like making it look like they were ungrateful, and they couldn't just throw it away because that would look really wasteful. So they started burying it. They were burying ham because they couldn't eat that much ham. They finally got caught when they started burying the corn. And the corn started growing there outside the POW camp. Yeah, it was just all this tons of food. And bear in mind, this is at a time when U.S. citizens are on rations. Like, we have less. You had to have ration cards for lots of goods at that time. And these POW camps, they started organizing. And some had orchestras. In fact, some had multiple orchestras. The one in Aliceville, Alabama, they put on an art show in a POW camp, and it was such a big deal that the Führer sent a gift of $12,000 for their art show. Hitler sent $12,000 to the U.S. so the German POWs could put on this art show. Now, this did not go over very well with the population in general. In fact, there was one well-known national radio announcer at the time. He was kind of a Rush Limbaugh of the day in that he did political stories that had a national audience, gained a lot of attention, and got a lot of traction. And so he was advertising this, and he was talking about how the U.S. was coddling their POWs, and then people in Congress started listening, and people around the country started raising Cain, and the conditions were so much better for the POWs than they were even for U.S. citizens, certainly the U.S. citizens who were in the internment camps, better than the conditions for U.S. soldiers, better some than even for free U.S. citizens out around in the public. In fact, one of the guards at Camp Forest read this little story. He was said, they were really short-staffed. You didn't have a lot of spare U.S. soldiers to guard the POWs. So they were having to pull really long shifts, and he was working on one of the guard towers out there. He was manned up in this this guard tower with a machine gun to keep the POWs from escaping. And he's like, it was so stacked that I got no leave. I could never leave the base. In the meantime, the U.S. Shortage of work was such that they were letting POWs go out and perform jobs. Some of you may have even had in your family's history some of the German, Italian, or Japanese soldiers who worked on your family farms, who performed jobs at factories. Like, they were just sent out to do these jobs, and they started forming relationships. They formed friendships with the families they worked for. Some of them even formed romantic relationships. So this guard at Camp Forest was like, you know, I couldn't even get off to go to town for any leave. In the meantime, the POWs have girlfriends in Tullahoma. They're going out on dates, you know. And so he was arguing about how unfair it was. And that sort of sentiment was going on all over the country, because this was not the only POW internment camp. In fact, by the end of the war, there were some 500,000 POWs in the U.S. Half a million POWs in the U.S. That's a lot of folks. And they were fulfilling a lot of jobs all over the country with really good conditions as compared to many Americans at the time. So Congress investigated, and they did this whole investigation about how we were treating and coddling these prisoners, and they listened to a lot of testimony, and they finally came back and said, well, we're doing it. We're just following the guidelines of the Geneva Convention. How many of you are familiar with the Geneva Convention? You're familiar with that? And so that's what they said was, we're following the guidelines of the Geneva Convention in the expectations that Japan and Italy and Germany would be doing the same. And that was their kind of final settlement. And about 3 weeks later, it was discovered that 89 American soldiers were gunned down as they were POWs. They were unarmed, and in some cases even unclothed, just gunned down in cold blood. And then a few weeks after that was when the U.S. made their way into the Jewish concentration camps and saw the conditions there. And all of a sudden, the American public was forced to ask the question, if we're not treating these POWs this way because they are treating our prisoners this way, American prisoners this way, why should we treat them well? I mean, that was the question. Why should we treat them this well when they aren't treating us this well? This morning, as we continue our study through Deuteronomy, and we're going to be really brief this morning, especially for you moms, I'm not going to keep you long, but we just want to think about that question, because the Israelites really had to ask the same question. How should we treat those who are not us, the foreigners, the aliens, those who act and look and speak differently than we do? Now, sometimes in Deuteronomy, we read accounts about how when they go into the promised land, they go into the land of Canaan, God says, you know, just kill all the inhabitants of this city. Other times he says, I want you to kill all the men, anytime Deuteronomy says, kill all the men, what he means is, kill all the fighting men. Right? This is not every male. In fact, if you go into a city and a man surrenders, you just take him as a prisoner. You don't kill him. And this was all of the fighting men. If they refused to stop fighting, that's when you killed them. So he'd say, kill all the men, and if there are any widows or women that you want to take as wives, you can do that. And so you get this kind of, what determines all this? And so without going into a lot of detail, because we're short on time this morning, just know that Israel was God's judgment on those nations. On the nations in the land of Canaan and on Amalek, the Amalekites, Israel was God's judgment on them. They had such ungodly, unholy cultures that God said, we can't allow this to continue. And so for them, yes, I want you to wipe out that entire pocket of civilization. But then after you settle in the land of Canaan, things look really different. For in fact, the rest of the entire known world, God has a very different stance for very specific reason. For instance, God says, do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner. residing in one of your towns. Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and they're counting on it. Otherwise, they may cry out to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. What? You're saying I have to treat a foreigner the same as a fellow Israelite? Why should I do that? Why should I treat foreigners who have no standing in the community, no power, no influence, just the same as I would treat a fellow Israelite? In America, we ask the same question. Why should we treat these foreigners who are coming to America the same as we'd treat an American citizen? Right? Still a relevant question. And God says, because you know what it's like. You should treat them well because you know what it's like to be powerless, to be foreigners in Egypt, to have to cry out to God for intervention on your behalf because they were mistreating you. You do right by the foreigner, not because they did right by you or because they even would do right by you. You do right by them because that's what you would have wanted if the situations were reversed. In fact, it is exactly what you wanted when the situations were reversed. In other words, sometimes we think that the golden rule is you do for others what they do for you. But what God says to the Israelites is, don't do for them what they've done for you. You do for them what God has done for you. And that is a heavy rule. You do for them what God has done for you. Continuing on real quick, he says, do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak from a widow as a pledge. In other words, like a down payment. Keep her cloak. She might need that, right? It says, remember, you were slaves in Egypt. Remember, you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. This is why I command you to do this. That's why I'm telling you to do this. Yes, there were laws that excluded the foreigners from the assembly for worship, right? There were also laws about Israelites not marrying foreigners. And again, without getting into that, it's not because the foreigners looked different or they spoke different or they acted different or they had different customs or ate different food. It had nothing to do with excluding them because they were weird or because they were different or because from somewhere else. It had everything to do with remaining faithful to God and not elevating false gods to equate with God. In other words, you don't invite foreigners into the worship assemblies, not because we have something against foreigners, but because they don't worship God. You don't marry women who are not Israelites, not because Israelite blood is pure, and by the way, if you go and read the history, you know Israelite blood is far from pure. Even Jesus, right? Jesus had multiple foreigners in his bloodline, and he was a Jew among Jews. So it had nothing to do with the purity of the race. It had everything to do with the purity of a covenant with God. You don't marry them because they don't worship God. In the New Testament, we have the same thing. You don't unequally yoke two oxen, right? What fellowship is light with darkness? You don't marry someone who's not a Christian, not because they have a different skin color or they speak a different language, but because they're not a Christian. Your decision on how you treat foreigners has nothing to do with the foreigners themselves. It has everything to do with God. Brothers and sisters, we're going to wrap up already. I know, moms are so excited. At some point, though, we have to ask ourselves how we, today, you and me, are going to treat others who are different than ourselves. Those people who are, they may be from different countries, or who speak other languages, or who dress differently, or who look different than us. We have to decide how we, you and me, are going to treat people who are not us. And there are some who live in our communities, and there are some who live in our state, and certainly many who live in our nation. But the basis for that decision has nothing to do with the others themselves. How we treat others has nothing to do with the others. It doesn't matter what language they speak. It doesn't matter why they're here or what they're doing here or what God, even it doesn't even matter what God they worship. By the way, did you notice that? The foreigners, you don't pay them less because they worship a different God. It doesn't matter what God they worship. Your decision on how you treat others has nothing to do with others, has everything to do with God. Jesus once told a parable that kind of illustrated this point. It's about a servant, and he owed the king, he was servant of a king, he's an important guy, right? And he owes the king like 10,000 bags of gold. Owed 10,000 bags of gold. Now, virtually nobody, certainly not a servant, is ever going to be able to repay 10,000 bags of gold. King calls him in and says, hey, you owe me all this money. Servant cries and begs and pleads and says, you know, I don't have it. Please, please, please. And the king says, you're forgiven. 100% forgiven. Now, this servant who is forgiven 10,000 bags of gold, he goes out to a fellow servant, a second servant, and says, hey, you owe me 100 coins. Like him, this servant says, but I don't have 100 silver coins. I can't repay you. Just give me some time. I'll work it off, whatever I have to do. And the first servant, the one who was forgiven 10,000 bags of gold, refused to forgive 100 silver coins and has the man thrown into prison. When this happens, the king hears about it, and he is furious. He is livid that someone who was forgiven 10,000 bags of gold could not then offer the same forgiveness to someone who owed 100 silver coins. So he has the first servant, the one forgiven the big sum, thrown into prison, and he says, you're going to be tortured until you can repay. By the way, a servant is not going to repay 10,000 bags of gold, no matter how much he's tortured. So you're going to be tortured for the rest of your life because you could not forgive one small sum. How do you treat others even when they don't treat you that way? Jesus says the basis should be on what God has done for you. It's interesting that when the U.S. was asked, okay, now we know that Germany's not going to treat our POWs well. We later found out Japan was not going to treat our prisoners well. How are we going to treat them? Even though we know they're not going to follow the Geneva Convention, what should we do? And they finally decided, to their everlasting credit, that it doesn't matter what the Geneva Convention says. It doesn't matter what Germany does. It doesn't matter what Japan does. It doesn't matter what anybody else does. We're going to treat them well because that's the right thing to do. We're going to treat foreigner POWs, enemy combatants, well because it's the right thing to do and it doesn't matter anything else. Yes, we know Germany was brutal. Yes, we know Japan was brutal. It doesn't matter. We're going to be better than that. The question for us this morning is, what will we do? How will we treat those who are different than us, who look, act, and speak differently than us? Because God says, remember what I've done for you, different though you are from me. If we can pray for this morning, lift you up, encourage you, we just want to do that. Won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?